Welcome to the Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by X2 Comedy. If you're looking to get more out of your Shenandoah Valley experience, then this is the podcast for you. You'll meet interesting people, the comedians that perform here, and find out more about what you can do and see. Whether you live here or plan to visit, listen to explore what helps make up our unique slice of heaven. Now here's your host, Dawn Davis Womack.
Hello, laughers. I'm so excited to introduce you to Maggie Mirangione. Maggie is a professor of American and Appalachian literature at Blue Ridge Community College. She is also the author of the newly released novel Across the Blue Ridge Mountains, now available at Barnes & Noble and Amazon. Her novel is set in the small town of Elkton, Virginia, in the early 20th century during the social and political changes of industrialization, women's equality, and the removal of the mountain families for the Shenandoah National Park. Her poetry has been published in Lumina Magazine, Sage Woman, and the North Shore Woman's Newspaper. Today's podcast is part two of our Children of the Shenandoah series, providing you additional historical perspective for Can't Feel at Home, an original play written by Dr. John Glick about the families that were displaced and directed by Stanley W. Schwartz. The play will be performed live at Court Square Theater in Harrisonburg, December 1st through the 4th. Welcome to the show, Maggie. It's great to have you on today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
I am too. This is, you sent me your website and I was just, oh my goodness, this wealth of information. I can't wait to get into this interview and hear more. I'm so thankful that Joe Appleton, who's one of the producers of the play Can't Feel at Home, connected us. I had no idea that you did all this research and you spent over 10 years doing it. It's so interesting and exciting to be with you today to learn more, especially after taking an in-depth look at the website, like I was telling you. So first thing I want to get into is that I noticed that you are from New York and you began teaching after you were an intelligence analyst. Mm-hmm. So let's start with New York. Where are you from in New York?
I'm from Long Island, New York, Nassau County. That's where I was born and raised and lived probably the first, I guess, 20-ish years of my life there with my family.
That's awesome. Now, I'm wondering, is it the intelligence analyst career that brought you to Virginia initially then?
Yes. When I graduated from college, I got recruited by the CIA. And so I went down to D.C. kind of blind to just to work for them. And that got me to Washington, D.C. And to relax on weekends, I started hiking in the Shenandoah National Park. And that was the start of me getting curious about the families who were displaced, because I would run across the chimneys. I would run across old structures and sometimes abandoned cemeteries, because I used to hike off trail a lot.
Oh,
just go rogue.
Okay.
Just go rogue, go off the trail. Off I went.
The hikers, they tend to do that, don't they?
Yes.
That's okay. So that's how you got interested in it. Is that play a part in your transitioning from your career as an analyst into teaching, your interest in these families? Or how did you go from your analyst career to teaching? I have so many questions, Maggie.
No worries. I did not like living in the city, and I didn't really like the stress of my job very much. And so while I was working there, I began thinking about, you know, where you really belong in the country, and that's what's going to make you the happiest. And I began thinking about, well, you know, if I got a teaching degree, which I always loved literature, and, you know, I said, if I got a teaching degree, I can go anywhere with that. You know, maybe teach anywhere. It kind of sowed a seed in terms of me figuring out how to escape my present career at that time and evacuate both the career and the city.
So that brought you into the Shenandoah Valley then, the teaching career?
Well, it was still a long time before I taught. When I first moved down here in the, I guess, yeah, in the 90s, the early 90s, 91, I moved to a small little mountain town in Vesuvius, Virginia. and immediately realized there were no jobs. I did a lot of like hodgepodge jobs, and to include riding a lot of horses and living on my mountain farm. And it was finally probably it took quite a few years before I finally started adjuncting. And then I got a full-time teaching position.
At Blue Ridge.
I moved to the Shenandoah Valley and that to where I live now in the town of Shenandoah, Virginia.
Oh, that's wonderful. When did you move to Shenandoah?
Let's see. I think I moved there. That was the late 90s. That was the late 1990s. I moved to Shenandoah. I know I've been living there about 24 years now.
Oh, that's great. So you're one of us now.
Oh, I don't know if they'd ever say that, especially looking at my last name. But anyway, I like that. I like that sentiment.
And that's fair enough. I hear you. Now, 10 of these last years, you have been researching these displaced families. And I imagine you have learned a great deal about them. How did you go about doing your research? What was your methods?
Right. As a researcher, I started this probably when I moved to Shenandoah, and I assumed I was closer to the Shenandoah National Park at this point. I said, oh, well, I'm a researcher. Researchers call archives and so I figured I'd just call the archives at SNP and go in there and do some research. Firmly said no. No, you cannot have access to the archives. And I tried a few various ways to kind of get in the door, and they were very adamant about no, people could go into the archives. And I actually recollect that as I was getting really ticked off about this, I think somebody actually sued them for them not being allowed to go into the archives. But long story short, I happened to see a little ad in the Page County paper at this time that the Shenandoah National Park was looking for someone to take care of their birds of prey, which they used in their educational program for the summer. They needed someone to feed them during the winter. So I said, I volunteered. And I kind of wormed my way through the door, so to speak, by taking care of their birds of prey, getting to know some of the rangers, getting to know the archivists, then volunteering in the archives. That's how I kind of got in the door.
Okay. Did you meet with descendants of these families, too, as part of your research?
That came out almost more holistically, as my neighbors and people I knew in the area knew of my interest and research, that would be like, oh, you've got to talk to my uncle. You've got to talk to my grandfather. Oh, you know, my family was displaced. And then certainly a lot of the students who go to Blue Ridge Community College, their families were displaced, or some of them.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it kind of grew kind of holistically.
Oh, that's great. So would you meet with them in their homes or meet them out at Barnes & Noble for coffee or where you are right now?
I go to people's homes.
Okay.
I mostly went to people's home. And I've got to also mention a wonderful resource. It was actually originally housed at the Shenandoah National Park, but they gave it to the JMU Specials Collections. There are a variety of oral history interviews of descendants of the park that were done by Dorothy Noble Smith and Darwin Lambert in the 1970s. So you can go in and actually hear voices. You can read the transcripts I think there's got to be over 50, 60 interviews.
Wow.
From descendants who got moved off the park. And these are people who got moved off. So the closest you can get to a primary source.
That's amazing. And that's at JMU's library?
And you can access it online through the special collections.
Well, that is really great. I didn't know we had that either. Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that resource source. What was the easiest and most challenging part of doing your research?
I guess, it was a slow process. You know, it wasn't like I spent 10 years, 5 days a week, you know, researching this. It was kind of piecemeal. And you kind of were a bit of a detective. And it was also kind of like a treasure hunt for information. And you would just get, you know, you would occasionally get these wonderful nuggets of information or an interview or some type of connection that began to build like all these little jigsaw pieces that began to build a bigger picture of the experience of the displacement.
Okay. I'm trying to envision how you kept track of all this information. Do you have like a research room in your home? Are you visual where you have to put it all out on a board, or is it all in
documents? No, my brain just worked better back then. So I could keep track of it. I forget if I did try this now, it would be a lost cause. But yeah, I don't know. I get a lot of files, mostly computers. I'm kind of old school. I used to print out. If I found something online, I'd print it out. So I kept a lot of files. So yeah.
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot of resources listed on your website mm-hmm. that are primary and secondary, that listed there. Can you tell us a little bit more about what may have surprised you the most during gathering your information?
Well, I think, you know, in hindsight, just the larger way the removals were conducted. You know, I've made more sense of it now, but I think the most significant, let's say, event or turning point was when I connected with Richard Robinson, a documentary filmmaker from Orange, Virginia, who had turned up the eugenics research and issues with some of the people who had been removed from the park through author Rothstein, a government photographer's photos. So that was like a very intense moment, if you will.
Mm. For those laughers and myself, I'm going to put myself included. I am not completely familiar with what eugenics is. Can you share with us a little bit about that to give some context?
Sure. The eugenics movement, you know, now is seen as a kind of a pseudo-scientific movement. Back then, it was kind of basically about racial purity, promoting the white race, Hitler. Is the most successful, I hate to say successful, certainly putting that in air quotes, proponent of or carried on the largest scale of the eugenics movement. But for the Shenandoah National Park and other people that I know of in, you know, for Virginia, you know, if you were labeled like feeble-minded was a word they used, imbecile, a woman who had children out of wedlock, you know, you were seen as less than desirable and could, again, these are words that I've come across, pollute the white race. So you'd be, you know, so the encouragement was to be sterilize these people.
Mm. Mm.
I know. It's a very dark, dark part of history.
Yeah, I think definitely unpleasant. I believe in skimming through the resources, there's some references that talk about that piece a little bit more, correct?
Yes, and I have on my website an interview with this documentary filmmaker, and it's about a half hour interview that you can hear him talk about this, and the photographer who, author Rothstein, who painted a very particular picture of the park residents, you know, the definitely maligning them.
Mm. How far would you say you went geographically to do your research on these families?
I probably at some point went to, you know, hit all the five counties that were were affected. Yeah. Of course, just from my locale, you know, I'd say Page County and, you know, the Elkton area were kind of my home base, I suppose.
Okay. Yeah. I was wondering what a typical meeting would look like with one of the descendants, with the families from the families of these people that were displaced. So when you met with them, what kinds of questions did you ask most often to help hear their story and put eventually this book together, Across the Blue Ridge Mountains? Yeah.
And to, by the time, you know, I came on the scene, most of the original people who moved off the park had passed. So these are their, you know, kind of the second and third generation. And one of the things that we would kind of always start with, well, first of all, there's always so much interest and they wanted to tell their stories because these stories had been so so buried. So there was a definite energy for telling the stories and for them to meet me. And we'd always start with photos. There were always wonderful, wonderful photographs that they share. And, you know, I think it's kind of interesting, you know, how the anger, you know, was still so strong and prevalent in, you know, second and third generations, you know, which I think speaks to historical and cultural trauma, which this community of people definitely suffered and their descendants suffer because there was so many unique variables about this displacement.
What were some of the unique variables mentioned or that you came across? Can you expand on that a little bit? Yeah,
sure. You know, certainly they're not the first group of people to be displaced. You know, we think of the Native Americans as lots of, and certainly when the Tennessee Valley Authority and the Blue Ridge Parkway went in a little south from us, you know, families were displaced, but there was such a large concentration of, you know, over 500 families in the proposed park area that got displaced. So that's one that was a very large, you know, and specific group of families. I think the second thing was the way the removals and even the organization of the Shenandoah National Park, it was, for lack of a better word, very wonky. You know, nothing went straightforward. There was, I think originally they didn't even think there were any families up there. You know, so that is, so the way the both Virginia and the federal government went about it wasn't terribly transparent. And I think the families themselves received a lot of conflicting information. You know, oh, you can stay. Oh, you can go. Certainly the concerted effort to depict them as illiterate, inbred. You know, if you look at the newspaper headlines from this time that appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, you know, families moved for their own good from the 19th to the 20th century, you know, kind of these ideas that they're holding America back. And so really hateful descriptions of a group of families that ran the gamut of economic demographics. And then, of course, you know, you throw in the eugenics piece and it just becomes, you know, a very, I feel, specific type of displacement.
Did you get into more of the research yourself on the eugenics piece?
That was, you know, interestingly, that was one of the last things that kind of popped and flew to the surface. It was kind of the tail end of my research when I discovered it. And I have to credit Richard Robinson with kind of really educating me on that. I didn't know that much about it either. So that was a big wake up call. You know, I'd heard of it, but I finding out that these eugenics laws were on the books in Virginia up until the late 70s.
Before they were taken off the books. Yes. Wow, that is very interesting. I didn't know that either. What was the most concerning part of that research for you in terms of people that live in our area, the eugenics piece? Do you have any specific stories that you can recall that popped to the top?
This is not a, you know, I have a broad knowledge of this area. I'd have to direct people who are interested in that, maybe checking out Richard Robinson's documentary, and at the very least, the his website, as well as his interview that I have on my website for getting more specific information about that.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that's a very curious piece. I really didn't know anything about it. Do you know the name of his documentary off the top of your head?
Rothstein's First Assignment.
Oh, thank you for that. Okay, so we can look that up and put that link in the show notes for people if they want some more information. In your book, the character, the main character, her name is Mary.
Yes.
And from everything that I can tell, this Mary seems like a real person who lived during this time. Is that correct?
Yeah, she isn't. But most people that have been, the feedback I've been getting from people who have read the book, they think she is a real person. So I guess I did my job well. In fact, one of the earliest manuscript workshops I went with this book, the three other people in my group who were reviewing my manuscript, you know, they said, we thought maybe that Mary was you. And we started doing research because, you know, yeah, it was just, but they realized, you know, I'd be 190 years old, but, you know, so that was kind of interesting. I'm glad I created a character with such a strong voice, personality, and that seems so real. That's wonderful.
Yeah, you did a really good job, because that's exactly what I thought. So, how did you come up with this character, and why did you choose the way you wrote her story or her narrative as the primary focus? Is she kind of a summation of people at that time's story?
No, she's her own, you know, character.
Okay.
Certainly, you know, she's just her own character. It was nobody in mind I had when I wrote her. She's just a conglomeration of experiences and observations of my, you know, in my life, so to speak, as well as the research and putting her in a specific place, because she's also a product of the history and the culture of that time. I think one of the things I try to get at is you've got a young woman who, you know, in 1918 wants more for herself than, you know, marriage and children. But though, you know, there weren't that many roles available, you know, for women back then, you know. She's just like I said, a conglomeration of experiences.
Yeah, I love that you set her in the early 20th century. Out in Elkton, the small town of Elkton. Why did you choose Elkton?
Because I'm in there all the time. I live right next to it. I'm there all the time. I'm at the community center. I'm at the feed co-op. I'm at the Food Lion, and I know Elkton. And I know all the people. You know, I don't know all the people, but I mean, I know I know the history just from living there.
I love that. You're delightful. On your website, I was most intrigued by one of the tabs you have on there, Mary's World.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I love Mary's World. And then when the drop down menu, you see recipes, songs, and photos. So where did this is a character you created then. So where did the recipes, songs, and photos, the photos look real and historic. So where did you find all these?
Yeah, they're open source photos, but it's interesting. You know, when I first wrote the novel, and of course it went through two major edits with two different editors. I originally had envisioned it as kind of a quilt. So I actually had these recipes and these photos embedded in the story to kind of make it seem even more real, if you will. But then one of my editors made me pull all that stuff out. He said, suggested I put it on the website. But those recipes are all recipes I've probably cooked. They're kind of my home recipes. So the recipes are mine for the most part. The photos were just photos I found, and they just inspired me. And then, the music, one of my loves is Appalachian and bluegrass music. So the music is, you know, pulled from the area. In fact, one of the most delightful websites, if you're really into local history, is called, let's see, from Brown's Gap to Bacon Hollow. It's another one that's on my website, but it actually has the pictures, has a lot of pictures. It has a lot of the original music from the song catchers that came through in the 1900s. So you can hear early recordings of a lot of this old time Appalachian music. And certainly that was an inspiration to me.
Oh, those are really great. Yeah, I listened to both of the songs and I know what bluegrass is, but I can't say I'm a connoisseur, let's just say, but I did enjoy it. And the stories, the one of the songs sounds like it might be from a descendant or a person from Appalachia, from the area. Is that correct?
Well, Across the Blue Ridge Mountains is that actually a song about. So that was maybe the original inspiration for me for this novel, because it's a young girl who's singing. It's a mother and daughter singing to each other. I'm in love with this man. And the mother's saying, you know, no, he's wrong for you. And, you know, he's going to take me across the Blue Ridge Mountains. To her ruination, you know, and originally I heard it sung by Mary Bird McAllister, who is a real person from Brown's Gap, which is kind of outside of Grottoes, Virginia. She was known for singing that song. And it's a beautiful song. You can hear it on that website I mentioned, Bacon Hollow, Brown's Gap to Bacon Hollow, I think it's called.
Oh, see, now I think I'm putting my own dots together a little bit, I think, about why people think that Mary is a real person, because there's some reference to that Mary that you just mentioned, mm-hmm. and then the Mary's World tab. You just feel like, oh my gosh, this is the real person. I'm just fascinated that you created her as a conglomerate of your whole experience and the experience of these families that lived here and were displaced. This is a rich book.
Thank you.
And I just am amazed by what you've done. And it's years in the making, like the play Can't Feel at Home. It's like all these worlds are converging together about these people's stories, and it's
beautiful.
Yes,
maybe it's the time that these stories, you know, get heard and get heard on a larger scale. Because really, it's I guess maybe some people have a regional knowledge of it, but unless you know you're kind of one of the descendants, I don't think many people know, you know, about the families that were displaced, and certainly all the variables of what happened and what went down with that displacement. So maybe now's the time that it becomes a little bit more well-known and recognized.
Yeah, maybe it is. And I think, you know, people are complex. My therapist, I call her Boss Babe, says that all the time. People are complex. And this is a lot. There is a lot of complexity around this story, historically, and the families themselves and their stories, and just what has happened over time in terms of how much information is or isn't getting out. And I think you're right. I think now is the time where people can receive all of it, the bigger picture, and hear the truth of this. Yes.
And one of the things, you know, both I think of my book and I think of the play is, you know, all human beings are primed for stories, mm-hmm. you know, and stories is such a wonderful way to get information to people, you know, because if anybody, you know, nobody wants to pick up a history book or an academic article or something, but, you know, to hear a story, you know, once upon a time, and then it brings you into this world. You know, I think that's kind of the magic of fiction and plays and all literature.
I agree with that. It's very relatable. as every one of us has our highs and our lows, things that went well, things that did not, things that we did not want to happen to us and happened yes. anyway.
Bad decisions.
Right. And then dealing with all of that. Some of those bad decisions were decisions we did not make, yet we're dealing with those decisions.
Yeah, I refer that to that stuff as, right, some things we were personally responsible for setting in motion in our lives. But, you know, also, you know, there's those meteors that just fall out of the sky. You
yeah.
know? And just hit us in the head.
I know. And I can't want it. I can't want any of it.
Right. But I think that's one of the things I bring out. I make that character, Mary, you know, walk her, you know, and deal with the fallout from her own decisions. And again, having to get, you know, with get through her life with grace when also the meteors are falling out of the sky.
Yeah.
Which we all have, you know, our own personal mistakes and our own meteors.
Yes. I like how you put that other, you know, earlier, like there's the ones where we have the responsibility because we created them. And then the ones that just hit us on the head out of nowhere. They both exist, you
yes.
know?
Yes. And that's life.
It's life. And you know, we grieve. We celebrate the things that are wonderful and go great. And naturally, we're going to grieve over the losses. And right. when we don't grieve over the losses, then that will just keep, that story will keep repeating itself and repeating itself and repeating itself until
yes.
we honor it and name it.
Very
then
good.
We're able to move through it and past it.
Yep, so, very well said.
Yes. And that's what's happening, I think, now. Rightly so. To mm-hmm. be, I'm put myself in their shoes. If my family had been displaced, I imagine I wouldn't like that, not one bit. And
you know, yeah. I have, I'm a person who doesn't like a lot of change, so that's mm-hmm. one thing.
Yeah.
But I cannot imagine, and I am very married to a sense of place. You know, once I put mm-hmm. down my roots, I put down my feet. You know, I'm there. You got to get a crowbar to get me out. And I feel that way about my farm I live in now. And I can't imagine, and I've only lived there 24 years. I cannot imagine having lived in a place 150, 200 years, generations of my family, and having to walk away and then possibly see it burned behind
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm.
I could not imagine. I would have lost my mind. I would have been one of those crazy people with a shotgun.
Yeah,
I would have lost my mind.
Right?
So I can't imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, yeah, again, the complexity, because now we have this gorgeous park that countless families have enjoyed and continue
right.
to enjoy, and the mm-hmm. awe and beauty of it and the memories that are created there, and the hikers that even have come through that are now connecting the past with the present in their mm-hmm. beautiful work that they're doing, like you.
Yes, thank you. And you're right. And that's something I also realize, an outdoor lover and a natural space lover, that, you know, if we didn't have a park up there, would we be looking at townhouses or, you know, development, you know, vacation homes? So I understand that there is a lot of complexity and controversy, you know, it's almost bittersweet. I guess that's the right maybe description. It's a bittersweet.
It is a bittersweet. Lots of things can be like that, you know, and we
yes.
look. Yes, we can. We got it. Yeah. Accepting takes a minute. That's when it's big. I've learned, you know, that the bigger the meteor, the tougher it can be to accept. Okay?
Oh, I know. I know.
I know I'm speaking to somebody out there who's going preached on.
Yes.
But we can, and we take our time with it, and honoring. What has happened to us is a huge part of the healing process. And I feel like people that are helping getting these stories out are doing just that. They are honoring these families. Yeah.
You know, and I think of even just these last few years, I guess maybe the last 5 years with the Mountain Heritage Project, you know, in every county, that was affected. Now they have, or I think they have it in most of the counties now. I know they have one in Page, Madison, Green, and Rockingham, because it's in Elkton, is that chimney and
yes.
the names of all the families that were displaced. I mean, a monument. I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, I think that it's the Blue Ridge Heritage Project, yes. Bill Henry. Go. Yes. And they're doing the chimneys. They got one more to go. We talked about that on the Children of the Shenandoah
yes.
part one. So laughers, you can go back and listen to that episode to hear a little bit more about those chimneys. But that is something you can certainly do to, in a way, honor the families. Also, if you're just learning about this or want to, in a way, do that, you can visit these different chimneys and see those plaques of the names of the families that were displaced. That would be one way to do it. Get you out and about in the fresh air, too.
That's right. It's a beautiful time of year for that.
Exactly. Well, what do you hope people will get out of reading your book specifically, Across the Blue Ridge Mountains?
Well, I think two things, you know, certainly hearing, I think, like all these variables that we talked about that affected the displacement, I've woven into the book, even having, you know, these recipes and photos and all that, you know, the rich culture that was up there. And then just, I think on a parallel track is just the story of Mary, who is a very strong character, and she's a survivor. And not just a survivor, she's a thriver. So I think, you know, despite she's, you know, from the early 20th century, I still see her as kind of a role model for getting through life. I mean, she had to learn this, but getting through life with grace, you know, so that's what I think of when I think of my novel.
I think that is encouraging and empowering, considering we all go through it. So it might be going through different things, but we're going through it. So
you have to get to the other side.
Yeah, gotta get to the. I love that. That's a beautiful. I can't wait. I've heard great things, and Joe can't say enough about it. And I'm very much looking forward to learning more about what you do, your research, reading this book. And I highly recommend for people that are interested in these families. Descendants, I'm sure, would be very interested in your book as well. So I highly recommend it. I really appreciate it. As we wrap up here, can you share with the laughers how they can follow you on social media or otherwise to get more information on your book, Across the Blue Ridge Mountains?
Yes. My website right now is I'm posting, you know, my speaking engagements as well as any new bits of information. Like I'll have something up there about this wonderful play that's going to be produced at Court Square Theater. So I would say my website, that's msmarinjoni.com. And then there's you can fill out a contact sheet and I can keep you in the loop for other things that are happening.
Excellent. And we'll, laughers, we'll be sure to put that information for you in the show notes as well. Her last name is spelled Marangione. That's Marangione. Maggie, Maggie. But again, we're going to put that link for you in the show notes as well. So if you're driving or working out, you won't have to worry. You can just find it real easy that way. So Maggie, this has been incredibly informative and truly amazing chatting with you today on all things Across the Blue Ridge Mountains. Thank you so much for sharing your story, a little bit of it anyway, your research and your novel with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on your show today. And I really appreciate your insightful questions.
Oh, thank you. I like them too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Laughers, be sure to check out Across the Blue Ridge Mountains and buy her book on Barnes & Noble or Amazon. And on November 15th, you can join Maggie at Pale Fire Brewing in Harrisonburg for a discussion on her book sponsored by WMRA. also in November. You can check out the next episode in the series on the Children of Shenandoah Part 3. Members of the creative team for Can't Feel at Home, the original play written by Dr. John Glick, honoring these displaced families, will be joining us. You'll get a more in-depth look behind the scenes and perhaps even hear an excerpt from the play. Can't Feel at Home runs December 1st through the 4th at Court Square Theater in Harrisonburg. Buy your tickets at courtsquaretheater.org. That's theater with an E-R dot org. We'll put information about Maggie's book discussion at Pale Fire and the web link to buy tickets to the play in the show notes for you as well. And lastly, and most importantly, thanks for tuning in, laughers. Out of all the podcasts out there, you picked us, and we think that's pretty darn special, just like you. Until next time, keep smiling. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by X2 Comedy. We'll be dropping a new podcast every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, so check back for another uplifting episode. Come to an X2 Comedy show or let us bring a show to you. To find out more, head to x2comedy.com. Be sure to share us with a friend. Until next time, cheers.